I'm Dave Ingstead, and I'm on part two of a three-part series looking at our relationships with the poor. And the title that I've chosen for tonight is Codependency Makes a Poor Universal Language. I mean that in both ways. It's a language that we use with the poor. It's also a poor way to relate. And so my thesis is for the evening that I think many of our relationships with the poor look to be, as I observe it, codependent, and therefore unhealthy and not very satisfactory. But I want to spend some time, fleshing that out, and so we'll do that first, and then spend some time in discussion and in reaction, I suppose. Were any of you at John Fish's sessions earlier in the week? I'm just curious if that is a foundation. Okay, one was at that time. A man earlier in the week had a rather intriguing series of sessions, the middle one of which was entitled How the Helping Professions Destroy Community. And I think that reflecting on that, as I looked at that, I think codependency was at work as maybe one of the chief contributors to the breakdown of healthy relationships that are formed between helping professions and the poor. I want to do just a couple words of preface before we look at this topic in particular. One is that when I use the word codependency, it feels to me like that's kind of a loaded term. We'll spend some time talking about a definition for it, but it's my suspicion that for Lutherans especially, it's okay to be sinful, but it's not okay to be dysfunctional or emotionally unhealthy or codependent or addicted or whatever. And so we can say every week, I confess that I am in bondage to sin and cannot free myself, and that doesn't cause us any unrest. But if we were to discover that we were in some way behaving in a relationship in a manner that could be called codependent, that might cause us some anxiety. And I think it's important just to recognize that. It's also my belief that I would be surprised if we, meaning every one of us, did not participate in relationships, in some relationships, in a codependent fashion. If it's the first time you've been exposed to this kind of language, I doubt that you'll become familiar with it tonight, though it may open some doors, and it may be that you will react a little bit defensively. Might just be good to know that in advance. For me, one of the reasons I use the language is because of my own personal experience. And I am presently in a stage that I would call active recovery from both dysfunctional, what I would label dysfunctional, and addictive behavior. And myself participate in two different 12-step groups. And so it's a language that I not only hear in those groups, but that I carry with me kind of every day of my life. So it's language that I have come to feel comfortable with, but that's part of a personal journey. And I'm inviting you in some ways to come along with me in using that language as a way of talking about relationships with the poor. Okay, that's all preface. A little bit of a summary about yesterday. We started talking just in brief when a few of you were here about what we did yesterday. We laid our stories out side by side and saw that that while we share, there's many places where it seems like we share with the poor some common concerns and interests, yet we come at that in a very different way. For example, we might both be concerned with housing. That might be a concern of both of ours. It seems as if when we talked about our stories, our concerns about housing might be which house to buy, how to furnish that house, where that house is located. It might take more that shape than whether or not we're able to afford an apartment, what to do about the condition of the apartment, whether it be problems with pests or whatever, what to do when we're faced with eviction because we can't pay the rent. Our experience with housing may be very different than the poor's experience with housing, and therefore to say that housing is a concern we share in common doesn't necessarily give us a place to relate easily and share our experiences easily. What we really left with yesterday was a searching for some common ground. Where is there a common ground? I think there are many places that we could relate, but we're gonna kind of, for me, I'm gonna make sort of an intuitive leap to say, I think before we even so consciously as individuals jump at or work at trying to find some common ground to relate to the poor on, I think it's seductive enough to get drawn into an advocate or helper role that oftentimes that seems to be the way in which we more readily move into relationship with the poor, and that's what I want to focus on. I'm assuming with this group still, as I did yesterday, that most of us have spent some of our time and energy and attention focused on the poor, and that there's some kind of basic desire to connect with the poor, that we feel called to connect, but that we're not quite sure how to do it. Something seems to get in the way. And so for me, I think that what I observe, especially in my parish setting, is that people seem to connect to the poor as service providers or helpers or advocates. It feels like that's a way to validate their story. You know, we hear the poor talking about some of their concerns and issues, and it seems like to move into an advocate role is a way that we can connect with them. I also observe, especially in my parish setting, that people curiously seem to connect with that part of the story that causes us the most anxiety. If we're dealing with a group of people who are homeless, oftentimes all of our attention goes on, focuses on trying to address that issue, that problem. So we get all caught up in trying to find adequate housing for the poor, employment, housing for this population, employment for this population, and we become real fixated on that particular concern or problem. We try to fix it, we work to solve it, we want to address it. And as I talk about codependency, one of the things that complicates the picture is that there is a place for addressing the needs of the poor. The problem is when we take that advocate role and pull it and use that as the model or the process in our interpersonal relationships, it gets pretty muddy. And so I want to try to lay out one example of where to try to hold up some of those distinctions. If we look at a problem like hunger, just to take that as a for instance, it seems reasonable, it seems that many of us could come to a place where, as a faith perspective, we believe that it's kind of a basic human right that no one should go hungry or no one should go without adequate nutrition. We might be able to all agree that that's something we all can be committed to working towards. We may also see ourselves as responsible to help out, and we have biblical stories that push us in that direction. For example, the story of the Good Samaritan. The Good Samaritan didn't pass the person by on the side of the road, but stopped to help. And so we could quite, I think, easily come to a place where we believe that hunger is a problem that needs to be addressed, that people deserve adequate nutrition, and that we're responsible to help out in some way. And so we might decide to support to give our time and energy to a local food shelf or to a soup kitchen or food line of some sort as a concrete way of addressing the concern of hunger as we understand it. And at that level, at that basic service level, it's reasonable for us to talk about or to make decisions about who is served, what are the criteria by which people gain access to these services, how would we define adequate nutrition. It seems reasonable for us at that level to be problem solvers on that service level. And I wouldn't want to discount that at all. What I think oftentimes happens is that then we take that same process, that problem-solving process, and bring it into our personal relationships, so that when we relate to them on an individual level, we see ourselves as responsible to solve their problems. And when that happens, I think we have the beginnings of codependency. So what I'd like to do now, as best I can in a short period of time, is to talk about what is codependency and what does it look like. As a basic definition, I would say codependency is taking responsibility or assuming responsibility for someone else's life. And I want to come at that in a number of different ways to try to help you to understand that in a number of different ways, with examples and with some just descriptive statements. First, these are some characteristics of codependency, of taking responsibility for someone else's life. And they're written up in the form of I messages. When you're responsible, when I feel responsible for others, I focus my attention on trying to fix. I fix, I protect, I rescue, I control, I carry their feelings, I don't listen. I feel tired, anxious, fearful, and liable. And I'm concerned with the solution, with answers, with circumstances, with being right, with details and performance. In this kind of relationship, I am a manipulator, and I expect the person to live up to my expectations. I'm going to run by these all pretty quickly. We'll have time in the discussion to come back at that. Some other descriptive statements about codependency. And this is sort of, again, in a first-person type of person. Your struggles affect my serenity. My mental attention focuses on solving your problems or relieving your pain. That's one statement. My mental attention is focused on protecting you. My self-esteem is bolstered by solving your problems. My self-esteem is bolstered by relieving your pain. And I'm not aware of how I feel. I am aware of how you feel. I am not aware of what I want. I ask you what you want. If I am not aware, I assume. Those are all descriptive statements about codependency. Because, as I run by that, that's a little harder to get a handle on, I'd like to try in two different ways to look at codependency. One is by holding up an example from my own parish setting, and the other is creating an example and kind of step-by-step looking at how it might develop. The first example is an ongoing story about a woman who joined our congregation roughly 5 years ago. Her name is Mildred. And when she came to our congregation, It was with some celebration because she was a longtime resident of the neighborhood and poor. And like many churches who are struggling to address the needs of the poor, when one of them actually walks in your door, you rejoice. So Mildred came into our midst, and we were grateful that she would choose us as a congregation, as a community that she would want to join. A couple things happened almost immediately. First of all, she told us her story, which I could boil down by saying that at 2, she was abandoned by her mother. She was brought to a place called St. Joseph's Home for Children, and in the next 12 years, lived in 19 different foster homes. At the age of 14, she was emancipated, and that's apparently in Minnesota possible at 14, and has lived on her own ever since. She's quite a survivor. That was one part of her story, and in that, she was quick to point out how often she was rejected, how often that each of the foster home settings didn't work. Each time she came into a new foster home, they found some reason to abuse her or not to accept her, and so she had an ongoing story of rejection. Then she talked about her church experience over about the last 10 years. And you can kind of see this coming, can't you? She talked about her church experience over about the last 10 years and how in 3 different instances she had felt like the church had really rejected her. One elaborate story had to do with her participation in a church choir where it seemed like, as she described it, there was just incredible pressure for her to leave. They didn't like her personal hygiene and all sorts of things seemed to be problematic for them. And finally, you know, as she describes it, they just told her to get out. They just told her, you have to leave. And she had that story about 3 different churches. Well, those of us at Our Savior's Lutheran Church, hearing that story, did what most people do. We reacted with horror. How could this have happened to you? We won't let it happen. This won't happen at Our Savior's. You know, we will find a way to welcome you. Well, she's still a member at Our Savior's, which I suppose you could say is good news. But it has been an incredible battle ever since, because we're stuck in a very precarious relationship with her. We've taken on the responsibility to make sure that she doesn't feel rejected. And she, in turn, has pointed up frequently, every week sometimes, every month, the ways in which she feels rejected. Someone in church looks at her cross-eyed, and she's sure that they just don't like her. And she'll write notes and let us know that she just feels like it's about time that she leaves. She's on a number of our commissions, and in fact now she's even on council. And if she says something, and either it doesn't get any more publicity, or if people seem to take issue with it, then she's sure people are out to get her. They don't respect her opinions. It's one more sign that she's being rejected. And what we end up doing, we flip-flop. We go for a time where we're very energetic about trying to make sure that she feels welcome, that she doesn't feel rejected. It feels at that level like she's got all the power and the control, because she keeps naming these places where she feels rejected and we keep scrambling to make it better. Eventually, we get tired of that and we say no more, we quit. At that point, we flip-flop, and then we go through kind of a honeymoon period, and sometimes she kind of grovels, sometimes she kind of pouts, but she becomes like a little child trying to please you. And then she walks on eggshells, and then she'll send us cards and say, you know, I'm sorry, I must have done something wrong, you know, something like that. Well, that usually makes us feel terribly uncomfortable when she's putting herself underneath our feet. And so then usually what happens is we flip back to the other. And it's a cycle that as yet we haven't found as a congregation, I think, a good way to break. I think there are individuals who are breaking with that pattern. What's entirely forgotten in that whole picture is that this poor thing, who's so sensitive and who so easily feels rejected, has not only survived 19 foster homes, but has lived on her own for 24 years, and has survived on essentially no income, and is remarkably resilient and resourceful. We forget all of that. So that's Mildred. That's one way to picture codependency. It looks kind of obvious just to lay it out like that. You say, well, of course, that's not a very healthy relationship. Oh, I think the church behaves in a very codependent way with Mildred. Mm-hmm. And it always takes two. Mildred comes in with her story, but we get hooked into that. And I'd like to lay this out a little more precisely in a hypothetical example. And I hope it works to flesh it out. I think it will. Partly I do this just to see how it could begin, the whole cycle can begin, but also to see both sides of how people participate in, I think, a codependent way, or what I would call a codependent way. We could start with the example of a person. It doesn't matter who they are, and the problem is kind of arbitrary, but I was thinking that we might call the problem, we might say that the person's overweight. That's their problem. They're too heavy. You take an individual who is too heavy, could be male or female, and they have been unable to lose weight. They've tried any number of kinds of diets, and they're unable to lose weight. Well, that could be fairly common. Like the poor, I mean, there's all sorts of people with problems like that who don't seem to be able on their own, or at least haven't up to this point, find a way to resolve such a problem. To push the example a little further then, assume that this person has some friends who are concerned about him or her. And this is where the things get to be a little bit more muddy. They decide that it's time for you to tackle your weight problem. They think they have decided that you would feel better about yourself, that you'd look better, that you'd be healthier if you lost some weight. And they're doing this as friends. They're concerned. And they're not just willing to name it as a problem, but they decide that they'll set out and they'll help you. They're willing to offer you some help. There are clearly different responses that you could have to that kind of overture. I mean, the first one is simply to say it's none of your business. My weight problem is my own agenda. Some people say that when confronted with that kind of invitation to help. Another response might be to say, thanks for your offer, but I need to do it by myself. It's my problem to solve. A third option, and there's probably more than three, is to say, well, that sounds good. I think I would like you to help. And that third option, I think, is probably easier to fall into than we think, because of a number of reasons. It may be precisely because you have been unable to lose weight on your own that the offer seems attractive. Maybe these people know something that I don't. Maybe there's a way in which they can help me to lose the weight. You'd really like to lose the weight. It seems like, you know, what can you lose by that kind of invitation? What have you got to lose? When you set out, when you take that bait, it feels like the relationship is starting to head for the rocks. And you don't have to play it out very long to see how that could happen. If the weight somehow magically comes off with their support, of course there's no problem. Nothing destructive has happened. If, however, you decide together, you're trying to lose weight and your friends say they'll help you, and you set upon a realistic goal, you say, I'd like to lose 15 pounds by August. I think that's realistic. You set that as a goal. But if, however, those 15 pounds don't magically come off, and it's August, and your friends have seemed to be, and your friends have been involved, and you've worked hard, expectations can easily start to get confused and crossed. It would not be uncommon for your friends to tire of the effort. They might feel that they've been working pretty hard. They might even say, it doesn't look like you're trying. You know, we've been doing a lot. We're encouraging you. We're calling you on the phone. We've brought you to the same weight loss classes that we're taking. They've worked for us. You know, something's wrong with you. What's wrong with you that it's not working? And it would be quite easy for the person, for you, who are trying to lose weight, to feel betrayed by their response, by such a response, and to accuse them of not being supportive. You might feel that you have been trying and that they're not holding up their end of the bargain. And that scenario, I think, is played out often. If that's what happens, if you get to that point in the relationship where you're really at odds, the best thing that can happen is that you learn that it wasn't their problem to solve in the first place. End of the story. A good lesson to learn, and you've avoided, I think, nurturing a very codependent attitude. However, the worst case is often what results, and that is that you come to believe that your friends' expectations were unrealistic, that they indeed were the ones that sabotaged the effort by their pressure, by their needling. You felt that they were setting up a condition that you couldn't win, and you might believe that you need to look for more supportive and sensitive friends, more caring friends to help you lose the weight. If there were no other more sensitive, caring, and supportive friends out there for you, it might still just end at that point. They might not emerge, and you might end up back at square one saying, I guess it's my problem to solve in the first place. However, it feels like there's an abundance of people who are ready to help. Because, like Mildred came to us, this woman, this man, might come with their story. I have a weight problem. I've been trying to lose weight. And as they tell it, they might convince you now as someone eager to help, as a sensitive, caring human being, they might convince you that these friends really set her up to fail, that she was really betrayed or he was really betrayed, that they were very insensitive, that circumstances were such, you were going through a divorce or your kids were teething or up all night, or there's all sorts of circumstances that meant you couldn't lose the weight in time, and these friends just didn't allow for any of those circumstances, and they will show you that they're very hurt. And being a very caring and sensitive person, you might be ready to promise, maybe you wouldn't, but many people are ready to promise that they won't abandon you, they won't desert you like those other friends will. You'll be there for her. And you get a pattern that begins to emerge. It probably won't work with these new friends any better than it worked with the old friends. But when the cycle continues with these new friends and they tire of the effort, there are probably more people out there who now, after two sob stories, will even be more touched and more ready to jump in and help. And after a period of time, the person can begin to forget that it was their problem to solve in the first place. And they can begin to believe that it's your problem to solve. And they come to you, now not even so subtly, with that as a hook. This is my story, I have a problem, and it's yours to solve. It may be that in this kind of instance, you might find yourself less susceptible to getting hooked in by that because it's a weight problem. But when it's a problem like poverty, there's even a bigger hook, because those of us who are wealthy might feel a little bit guilty about our wealth. We have possessions, we have money, we're not hungry, we have housing. And now when the poor come to us with those kind of stories, it's fairly easy for us to get drawn into that kind of relationship where we promise we won't abandon them. We promise we'll be caring and supportive. we promise that we'll do better in helping to try to solve their problems. I think we could find ourselves at either end of this kind of relationship, but in terms of dealing with the poor, in my congregation, it's most often that we're on the helping end. We get hooked into stories like Mildred, which isn't so uncommon in terms of stories of the poor. And we don't find ourselves able to create out of that a healthy relationship. I'm going to say just a few things in conclusion and then invite some discussion. If when we hear those kind of stories, we're predisposed to rescue the people or protect the people or solve their problems or prove ourselves to be the better Christian, show ourselves to be more sensitive, caring, and supportive than those other peoples they have met, if we're inclined to blame those other friends that weren't able to help this poor person out, if we're inclined to excuse the failures of the past because of bad circumstances, or in any way suggest that the problem is out of their hands to solve, then I think we're headed for a codependent relationship. And in that kind of relationship, I think what happens is that you accomplish as little as possible because the person themselves does not take responsibility for their own life. One thing to say in conclusion, and then I want to invite some discussion. There's only, and this is kind of the fundamental tenet of recovery or of just of understanding codependency, there's only one person that you can change. Only one, and that's yourself. There's no way you can change another person. You can't keep another person from acting out in a codependent manner. You can't simply by acting in a healthy way, and we've learned that also as a lesson at our church, if we choose not to act in a codependent manner with these people, that doesn't automatically imply that they will relate to us in a healthier way. And sometimes that causes us great anxiety. But we can quit reacting to people's stories. And we can begin to see the poor as people. But we can ask that question tonight. I think that's probably the hardest place to understand what I would call a rightful distinction of a codependent versus a healthy relationship. I think that there are legitimate needs that people have, and that as Christians we're called to respond to those needs. The difference is responding to people's needs so that they are not hungry, or so that they are sheltered, or so that they have clothes, on the one hand, and responding to people's needs in such a way that we end up living their lives for them, that we treat them as if they are unable to make choices for themselves, wise choices for themselves, if we treat them in such a way as to say you're not responsible to do anything with your life. It's clear that I think we sometimes suggest that your life is in such terrible shape that it's no wonder that you choose drugs, or it's no wonder that you choose alcohol or whatever, and imply that circumstances have dictated that they are powerless to choose, and therefore we set ourselves up as somehow needing to work with them to sort of regain that ability to choose. As if we're capable of renewing or reinstilling in them a sense of responsibility. But they will never become responsible for their own lives as long as we continue to take care of them. Good example, thanks. Here's another kind of example. This happens fairly frequently in our church. We get a lot of people who drop in asking for money or some sort of assistance because of a crisis. It's oftentimes the case that someone will come in on a Saturday afternoon after Monday through Friday and Saturday morning is usually when the food shelves and other kinds of emergency assistance places are open. Or Sunday morning, either way.
Right
before worship, sure. That happens oftentimes. Or between services, that's almost worse. We'll come in and we'll give us a story about how they've run short of money. They, you know, their baby needs milk. They don't have any diapers left. They'll describe any number of circumstances which sound very legitimate. And they'll say, I have a paycheck coming in on Tuesday. Could you give me some money today? They'll say that. Well, it's not our practice at our church to give out money. It's also true that there are hot meals that are served 7 days a week at various locations. So one of the responses is simply to tell people, you can, if food is the issue, you can get a hot meal somewhere. But the other part of it is, some of these people always come in at the last minute. They probably knew that they were going to run short of money on Tuesday. But they wait to come in until they are absolutely broke. There are quite a few resources in our, at least Minneapolis-St. Paul area, to address basic needs. Diapers included, food and clothing as other instances, emergency shelter. We invite people to take some responsibility for identifying their needs ahead of time and for coming in and giving us some time to work with them on addressing those needs. If they know they're going to run short of money on Tuesday, they're inviting some trouble if they wait until Saturday afternoon. Most of the times, they don't want to come in before then because they want money. They don't want a bag of groceries. At least that's oftentimes my experience. But there is some responsibility that they need to take. When I first began in that parish, I think much more often than I'm pleased about now, I'd hear that story and I'd think, well, boy, you know, it's you're out of money now and there isn't anything open. We've got to help. We've got to give you money now, I suppose, because you can't go anywhere else. Now I'll often say, when did you know that you were going to run short of money? You know, did you know about this last Tuesday? And I'm willing to say, I'm frustrated or I'm angry that you're coming to me between services now and letting me know this when you could have come in, when you could have called me on Tuesday, and I would have had time and I would have been much more willing to help you out than I am now. There are some consequences for their behavior, and I think we can hold that out. That's reasonable. And but that takes a lot of work. I don't think we come by that naturally. I sure don't. I haven't anyway, and I have to really work like crazy to do that. You have another man that knocks on our door any time of day. He comes about once a month. It was probably 2 weeks before we left for Holden this time. When he showed up one morning, he had to get to work and he needed bus fare. And I'm trying to remember exactly what his line was. Well, I know he had to get to his job, and he missed the bus. He needed fare for a taxi, I guess, was what he wanted. And I thought, well, you have buses you can catch. If you had a job that you needed to make, and you knew when the buses left, you have some responsibility to get up and go out to the bus stop to catch your bus. It works that way for me. And it seems reasonable that should be up to him to be responsible for. Those are two examples.
It takes a lot more energy and a lot more thought to figure out what their responsibility is.
Yes.
Because they're not thinking that through.
Yeah.
They're bringing it to
mm-hmm.
you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's almost always a crisis. And when you are put on the spot, you're not just thinking about, I'm rarely thinking at the time, though more so now, about what's appropriate responsibility for them to take. I'm oftentimes thinking about my privilege. You know, maybe I'm out washing the car when they come by. I'm washing my new car and they're asking for bus fare. You know, guilt, guilt, guilt. And that's a real hook.
But then on the other hand, if you continue to be their caretaker and their provider, they're not really learning to be responsible or how to develop these skills for themselves.
No, they aren't. No. Not at all.
And that can just be real self-perpetuating.
What's frustrating, though, and why I think it's more seductive than it might appear when you just lay these stories out and we all kind of nod our heads and say, well, of course there's a convenient response. If, as we talked about yesterday, we really have a genuine desire, the Spirit tugs on us to connect with these poor, and if then you get someone like Mildred that comes in with her story, and you say, there will probably be people like that here, and you feel like what that does is pushes someone away, there's something inside that kind of churns about that for me. It feels like we're not connecting.
That you failed in some way.
Yep. And so I think it's that push, it's all of those Christian biblical images that drive us to pay our attention to the poor and energy and time in service and other sorts of ways that somehow makes it difficult to just let go of the story. We want to do something with the story. We want to honor the story some way. And so it's not real easy just to say, oh, you know, you're trying to hook me into a codependent relationship. I won't have any of it.
I started working with a young man in Omaha as our came into our shelter. We find it through the help of GSA, he got an apartment, and I spent the whole day taking from one department to another, you know, how the county works, getting GSA and then getting food stamps. Then getting him his apartment, and he was short $50 for his deposit, so I said, oh yeah, well, just write all this down in your little book here. And we got him settled in, and then he didn't have any money, so we got him some pantries from the shelter enough to keep him going for a long, long time. And then when he got his food stamps, and I don't think this is morally wrong, but it struck me at the time that I wasn't doing the right thing. I said, okay, you go ahead and buy a couple of canned hams, and I'll pay you for them, and then they'll give you cigarettes and a little beer money. And this went on for a couple of months, and I said, oh, this isn't getting it at all. There's something wrong here. I said, you know, I think you can get a job, you know. You don't know, you've got 5 years. You could have a cure before this is all over. You'll have to get a job. Then finally, one day, he said, loan me $2. I said, nope, this is it. This is the end of the line. You just got to get a job. That's all there is to it. And I find out since then what they call the term enabling. You aren't doing very good, you're really hurting them. Because then they won't take the responsibility to share. Sure.
It's like having children. The most difficult part of being a parent is trying to make them responsible. It's easier to say, well, stop fighting this and don't do this yet, or, well, I don't know what you did with your money, but here's another corner to stop crying.
Yeah. And it's possible that in some ways it frightens all of us to think that we're the ones ultimately that are responsible for our own lives. We don't really have time to spend on this particular sidelight of codependency now, but there are probably places in our own life that are painful enough or scary enough that one of the motivators for getting involved in a relationship where we focus our attention on someone else is that it takes attention away from something that's happening in our own life. And so we become somewhat addicted to other people's problems because our own problems we don't know how to solve. And that's a whole nother dimension of codependency. But that's, I think that's a big part of it too.
Thank you. things that I feel is the most painful, being around people that are financially poor, but that isn't the main poorness in them, is that they don't have friends.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And just to be able to listen to their story with some empathy and yet be able to confront them, like you're talking about, really helps them grow. I've been involved in this for years, and when I think back of how I used to react like you did John, respond, I can almost laugh at myself and almost, you know, see what progress I've made in knowing mm-hmm. how to deal with them mm-hmm. and being helpful to them instead of just doing for them. Mm-hmm. But it takes time to listen to them and to listen to their story, and there's where I think the real Christian response comes in, is to know that you are caring. They can mm-hmm. tell. They can tell if you're just hearing another story, if you're really zeroing in on their and identifying with their situation and maybe sharing some of your own difficulty with them, and to see them progress. And we have two women living in our home right now, two homeless women. And I live with two other adult women that you have to keep examining whether we're enabling or how much we're going to be helpful and where it's going to end. And mm-hmm. we just have to keep examining that constantly. But when we can sit back and say that so-and-so is really doing something now for herself, you can see that you've helped them in some way by not letting them get by with just maintaining.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that that's maybe what our response should be, is to just befriend them.
And we have, yep, and I think we have to know ourselves very well to do that. Because those stories, they're tear jerkers sometimes. And especially when you add the component, Mildred doesn't have any other friends either, you know. Well, you add that on to everything else, and it's real easy to feel sorry for someone, you know, and you know, our great big nurturing Christian hearts want to just wrap our arms around them and say, I'll take care of you. It's really, it's kind of a tightrope that we walk between being supportive and loving, not enabling, and caretaking.
That's just what I was thinking. There's such a fine balance,
mm-hmm.
you know, where
mm-hmm.
one stops and the other begins, and you just have to watch that in your relationship.
That's why it's complicated. I think that's what makes it real complicated. When I first started my own recovery process, it seemed like the only alternative to codependency was just kind of complete detachment. Detachment meaning, you know, blowing people off. And that's not it at all. but finding that other place, that way to be supportive while still allowing someone the responsibility for their own life, is the whole process of recovery.
We had a family at the shelter in Omaha, and when we closed down in June, they had to go find somewhere else to live. They had been given notice a month, 3 weeks, 2 weeks in advance. And finally, up to day one, we had to load their clothes and put them in the hallway and say, this is it. And then we checked finally with Douglas County, and they had invested $140,000 in that one family through counseling mm-hmm. and this and mm-hmm. that. And up to noon of their last day, they had not found out where they were going to live. And come mm-hmm. 7 o'clock, they pull up in a car, and they mm-hmm. finally found friends that were going to let them in for 3 days. I wonder if 3 days won't stretch till 30, you know?
Yeah. Well, that works. I think for a lot of poor people, for a lot of people in general, those kind of stories work. You create a situation where you're in crisis, and there's a lot of people who are willing to jump in and help you out.